The news out of West Africa is bleak. In February, Foreign Policy reported that violent extremist attacks in the region had skyrocketed in the previous 18 months, with the Sahel experiencing the most rapid increase in activity of any region in 2019. According to the Africa Center for Strategic Studies, the number of attacks in the Sahel has nearly doubled every year since 2015, reaching 800 attacks in 2019 that led to 2,600 fatalities. At the same time, climate change is having an outsized impact on the region. It's one of the most environmentally degraded parts of the world, and temperature increases are projected to be 1.5 times higher than the global average. A recent World Bank report, Accelerating Poverty Reduction in Africa, highlights some of the challenges. The report authors underscore the impact of rapid population growth on the continent. In the Sahel, the population is expected to more than double to 450 million by 2050, further compounding another trend that often headlines news out of the region, ongoing food insecurity. You're listening to Friday Podcast from the Environmental Change and Security Program and the Maternal Health Initiative at the Wilson Center. In this special series, Africa in Transition, produced with support from the Population Institute, we share insights from experts and practitioners focused on harnessing the opportunities in Africa's transition to enable a prosperous future. I'm Lauren Reese, and in today's episode, we'll hear from Chitra Nagarajan. Chitra is a writer, researcher, and activist based in the northeast of Nigeria, where she works to build peace and promote and protect human rights. She recently led a study conducted by the Berlin-based think tank Adelphi that addresses the connections between climate change and fragility in the parts of Nigeria, Chad, Niger, and Cameroon that border Lake Chad, home to more than 17 million people. Through the locally led study, researchers identified 10 entry points for action, among those broadening people's access to basic services such as education, health, water, and sanitation, support communities to adapt to climate change and improve natural resource management, build social cohesion within and among communities, and review and adapt the security tactics used to combat armed opposition groups. As crises become increasingly complex around the world, these studies underscore the need to adapt how we address insecurity. Chitra, thank you so much for joining us today. I'd love to start by inviting you to share with us the path that brought you to your work in Nigeria.
Well, I've been working on issues of conflict, insecurity, human rights, and peace building for a number of years. And I moved to Nigeria in 2013 to work for an organization that was a big peace building program, working on conflict mitigation and peace building around the country. And it was originally an 18-month contract, and now all these years later, I'm still working in and on Nigeria and very happy to be doing that.
That's wonderful. One of the interesting takeaways for me from your research was that the communities around Lake Chad have actually developed to be adaptable to changes in the environment, so including a rich history of migrating to support their livelihoods. This adaptable lifestyle was really an outgrowth of population growth, droughts, and the shifting shoreline of Lake Chad. So what's changed to complicate this, what has traditionally been an adaptable lifestyle?
Mm-hmm. So the communities around Lake Chad have seen change historically, right? So Lake Chad itself has never been fixed. It's always been expanding and contracting and expanding and contracting. And the communities around the lake really adapted to be able to deal with those changes. But I think what we have seen in the last few years is really a combination of increased climate variability. And by this, I mean increasing temperatures, increased unpredictability of rainfall. So people don't know when it's going to rain, how long it's going to rain for, how much rain is going to come, and when the rain will stop. Also things like increased wind speeds as well. So on the one hand, you see really profound and dramatic climate change. And on the other hand, we've seen high levels of insecurity around the lake as well. And this too, interacting with each other, that's what's really made life very difficult for the people living around the lake. So the adaptation mechanisms that they had before, whether that's diversification of livelihoods into different crops or doing crop farming plus livestock rearing plus fishing on the lake, or whether it was moving to different areas depending on what was happening when it came to soil fertility. Those adaptation mechanisms are no longer available for people because they're not able to move due to increased insecurity, and they're not also, they don't also have the capital and the savings to be able to pursue different livelihood streams. So if one livelihood fails, that's it. They don't have other livelihoods to fall back on. And in addition to that, there's very little land around the lake, particularly in the most highly insecure parts, that is both fertile and secure. And at the same time, you have increased population density. So more numbers of people who are wanting very small amounts of land that are fertile and secure. And at the same time, you have the impact of military and security restrictions as well.
What kind of restrictions do you see?
So, for example, you have militaries of the region restricting the kinds of crops that can be planted. And that's really to make sure that the crops don't grow too high, because they worry that armed opposition group fighters can hide in amongst tall crops. So this was very clear to me, you know, living and working in Nigeria, Northeast Nigeria for so long, and really being used to driving around and seeing very far distances. When I went to the north of Cameroon, and there you don't have such restrictions, and you can really see how fighters could hide in the crops that grow. So crop height restrictions. Also closure of markets, which has really profoundly affected incomes and livelihoods. And the reason why these markets have been closed is because there are concerns that, again, armed opposition groups may be benefiting financially from these markets. Restrictions on farming in particular areas, restrictions on fishing. Yes, and then in addition to looking at crop heights, also some military personnel have engaged in deforestation, so cutting down forests and trees, again, because there's concern that they may be used to hide by their enemies.
So in the course of your research for the Lake Chad Climate Fragility Assessment, you spoke to over 200 community members, is that right?
I think it was over 250, yes.
Okay. So these are people living in communities that rely on the lake for their livelihoods. I think, you know, it'd be really interesting to hear from you some of their stories and how they are experiencing the different types of risks on the ground.
Yes, I mean, let me start by saying that your experience really depends a lot on who you are. It depends a lot on your gender, on your age, on your social economic status, your ethnic and religious backgrounds, and also whether or not you have a disability. And it's very clear, and we know this from other contexts as well, that the people who have faced the most risk and who have been affected the most are those who were already vulnerable and marginalized beforehand. Or people who acquired vulnerabilities. Women and men face very different risks and challenges. So whereas men are much more likely to be viewed with suspicion by all parties to the conflict, more likely to be in detention, more likely to experience extrajudicial killing, and more likely to be forcefully recruited. I mean, that's not to say that these things don't happen to women, they do, but they're more likely to happen to men, especially, you know, men of fighting age. Women are the ones who are left behind when men are killed or are fighting or are in detention or actually leave the area in search of livelihoods elsewhere. So if you look at most populations in areas controlled by governments, The majority of people living there are women, women of all ages, elderly men, and then young boys. And so you really have women heading households, finding ways for families and communities to survive and keep going, having decision-making power and roles that they didn't have beforehand, but also facing very high levels of sexual violence and other gender-based violence, whether that's sexual exploitation and abuse, so people saying to them that they will only give them food or shelter or protection if they have sex with them, engaging in being forced to engage in sex work. There are some indications of increased early marriage, particularly for girls who have been orphaned, increased levels of domestic violence and abuse, and other forms of gender-based violence as well.
Are there any efforts to address some of the sort of gender-based violence, the early child marriage, the, you know, some of the increasing rates of what we see as undermining women's empowerment in the region?
Yes. So, I mean, maybe I can start by saying that I think the picture for women's empowerment is very mixed. So on the one hand, women have really suffered a lot of harm. But also we see in the region, as we see in other conflict, post-conflict contexts, the conflict has kind of created a window whereby women have been forced, whether they like it or not, to take on roles that were previously denied to them. And in doing so, have power, particularly decision-making power, that they necessarily didn't have beforehand. And you really see how women have transformed their own understanding of what they're capable of, and also their desires for what they want for their girl children. So I've spoken to a number of women who've told me things like, my daughter has to go to school because going to school gives you access to better livelihoods and better opportunities. And what we have learned is we can't rely on anyone. We can't rely on our husbands or our fathers. We can't rely on the government. We can't rely on our community leaders. You have to be self-sufficient. And I want my daughter to have education, to have access to opportunities so that she will not suffer the way that I have and the way that I am. Because I know that I grew up thinking I would always be able to rely on my family members. But I know that's not the case, and I don't want her in the future to go through what I've been through. So it's very hard, actually, but I think through the massive societal rupture that we're seeing, there are also opportunities for women kind of realizing what they are capable of, and women standing up for themselves, women having power and making decisions that they weren't beforehand, whether that's within the family and the household or in the community at large. So there are, in a number of places, women who are acting proactively to support their communities. They're looking at potential threats and they're acting to stop them materializing. Because, you know, they'll say to you, I've lived through violence and I need to do everything I can to stop violence happening. So that's also positive to an extent. And as I said before, you know, historically we see this across the world when it comes to conflict, that because the men are away, because the men have been killed, and women are forced into positions that then can have, well, it can lead to backlash, but then in the long term, it can also lead to increased women's empowerment in the future. But to go back to your question, whether anybody is doing any work on gender-based violence in the region, I mean, there are people who are doing work on gender-based violence, but quite frankly, the work is not enough. It's not in enough places. And there are many gaps in what is being done. This is linked partly to levels of funding. So the response The humanitarian response in the Lake Chad region is underfunded, as are humanitarian responses around the world. And the response in general is not just underfunded, but in particular, the amount of funding that is required for issues of protection, including gender-based violence and child protection. If you compare what is required with what is actually available, it's far less than even the proportion of the humanitarian response that is funded itself. I would also say, in addition to all of this, for me, the focus has been on service provision, which is really important, and there's not enough service provision, as I just mentioned. But there needs to be a lot more work that's done on changing attitudes, particularly around challenging stigma, which both is a barrier to reporting plus a form of violence in and of itself. But also, as importantly as everything else, working on prevention. It's good to provide services to survivors of gender-based violence, but even better than doing that is preventing the violence from taking place in the first place. And we've seen very little truly preventative programming on the ground.
So Chitra, often left out of these conversations is a pretty significant part of women's lives, which is their reproductive health and access to services. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about how the conflict is impacting that in the region and where you see opportunities and needs to provide services.
Thank you. Thank you very much for that question, Lauren. I think there's a lot going on which is under the radar, and it's neither reported in media coverage nor is it recognized in policymaking and programming. And what we've seen is that women and girls do not have the ability to control their reproduction to the extent that they would like. We've seen, for example, programs around access to contraception being forced to frame themselves as being just contraception for women and girls who are married. And even then, husbands in particular not wanting women and girls, their wives, to access contraception. I do think that this is an issue of the masculine ego and thinking I'm a real man if I have lots of children. To the extent that I have spoken to young men in IDP camps who continue wanting more children, despite the fact that the family is struggling to take care of the children that already exist. And when you talk to women, they will tell you, my husband wants me to have more children, but me, I just can't because I can't look after the ones that I already have. And I think this is a really important aspect. And that's before we even go on to talking about women and girls who are not married, who find it even more difficult to access contraception. And this is one of several reasons why we're seeing an increase in women and girls in the region being forced to resort to highly unsafe methods to terminate pregnancies. I've spoken to healthcare professionals, I've spoken to women who want to terminate pregnancies, I've spoken to women and girls who have terminated pregnancies. And actually what we're seeing is a confluence of women and girls not being able to take care of their families, experiencing high levels of sexual violence, having their husbands not present, and high levels of victim blaming and stigmatization and shaming of women and girls who get pregnant outside the marital relationship, whether or not this is due to sexual violence. And I remember interviewing, I think she was 18, 19 years old, this young woman who was the sole survivor of her family. And she had been displaced into the nearest town. Her husband had been killed. Her parents had been killed. And she ended up in this town and she'd never left her village. And she didn't know where to go or what to do. And she came across a soldier who promised to look after her and set her up in a house. But obviously she had to have sex with him in exchange for this shelter. And then a few months passed, and not surprisingly, she got pregnant. And when she told him, what he did was arrange a transfer out of the theatre. And so she was left in this town. She had to move into a camp for internally displaced people, where she was really reliant. It wasn't even a camp. It was just an informal settlement. She was reliant on the goodwill of her neighbors. But she worried greatly that they would change their approach to her and their support for her when they found out that she was pregnant, because this pregnancy was, you know, done extramaritally. And when I met her, you know, the number one thing she wanted was for that pregnancy to end, but there was no access and no assistance to help her end that pregnancy. And that's just one of many, many cases I have come across in my time in Northeast Nigeria. Women in their 40s who are looking after, you know, half a dozen children and grandchildren, who are already struggling to cope, to look after them. Women and girls who have been raped, who become pregnant as a result of that. I interviewed this young woman who had been abducted and gang raped, and she managed to escape from the fighters and came back, you know, 7 or 8 months pregnant. And she said that after she gave birth, that baby would be a constant reminder to her of everything that she had experienced, plus also would mean that she was never accepted by her family and by her community again. And I think we really need to look at reproductive health and reproductive rights, women's choice over their body and what happens to their body. And we also need to look at, and I know this is a very controversial topic, but we also need to look at reforming the laws around abortion and expanding access to both contraception and abortion, and reducing levels of sexual violence.
Going back to what you were talking about with women in the community finding new roles of relative power and recognizing the important role that education can play for their own daughters. Are you seeing efforts to bolster girls' education in the region, or, you know, a broader recognition of the role that education can play in sort of long-term empowerment of women and economic growth? Are there actions being taken on the ground in that respect?
Yes, absolutely. And in some places, actually, you see access to education that was completely lacking beforehand. And I remember when I was in Chad, going to one of the islands on Lake Chad, and it was an island that was relatively close to Bol, which is the main population center in that particular region of Chad. And on the island, talking to people who said that before the conflict, there was no school on the island. And really, it takes a couple of hours to go to the island from Bol. And it's not as if the children on the island were going back and forth to school every day. The children on the island had no education, no access to education at all. And it was because of the conflict that a school was set up on the island and teachers deployed from other parts of the country. So I think for me, that's the most stark example of how access to education is expanding. And I think there is understanding of the need for these efforts to reach everybody, regardless of gender. There is room for improvement when it comes to access, particularly for children with disabilities. And we do not see enough programming looking at that. Saying that, though, I would say that what we've also seen as a result of the conflict is a changed attitude amongst many people to the idea of education in the first place, and particularly education that's characterized as so-called Western education. I mean, I don't really like the term Western education, because I feel that the things that are taught are insights that come from all parts of the world. And
right,
there's also a rich history and tradition of scientific discovery, developments in mathematics, etc., from Muslim majority parts of the world too. So I don't like that term, but that's how it's conceptualized in the region. So historically, in many parts, there was a bit of an antipathy towards this kind of education. And we've seen some changes in that, which also have allowed access. So both in terms of physical access to schools, also financial access. So in some places, school fees being waived, or families being given grants in order to enable children to go to school, but also changes in attitude. But of course, as I'm sure you can imagine, this is far from enough. And we still see many places where you don't have access to education, or for example, even in camps for internally displaced people, right. You see primary education, but then what happens when those children get to a particular age? And especially because these children now have this hunger and this desire for education, and they love going to school, yeah. And they love learning, and they have all of these ideas and dreams for what they want to do with their lives and what they want to be. So you see, you know, young displaced girls who dream of becoming doctors, but even where that education is provided, it stops at the age of 10 or 11 or 12. And then what happens to them afterwards?
That's really tragic.
And I also think there's something about giving people reason to hope, and then those hopes not materializing. So in this case, you have children who have been told that education is important to them. They have had some access to schooling. They're delighting in learning. And, you know, if you know any young children, you can just see, especially at that very young age, how much they love just learning things. And I've experienced that, you know, in many different countries. And so they have this sense of hope and possibility for their future and what they can do with their lives. And then that's cut.
The point that you just made, you know, gets to the issue of barriers to addressing some of these complex security risks in the region. Can you talk a little bit about other barriers that you see to how these complex security risks can be addressed?
Well, I think, first of all, the first barrier is a lack of understanding of what these complex security risks are and how they interact. So before we did our climate security assessment, and this is the Shoring Up Stability Assessment that was done by Adelphi, there was lots of talk around the impacts of climate change in the Lake Chad Basin, and what climate security looked like in the region, but actually very little recent empirical evidence. So, you know, I'm very happy that our report fills, at least to some extent, this gap. But I think there is, you know, so many things that we don't know about. And that is, you know, one of the first barriers to actually taking action on this. We also have the reality that in many parts of the region feels very distant from decision making and from the center, either because it is geographically or because it's distant in the imaginations of decision makers. We also see that, quite a gap in the presence of governance, let alone, you know, the effectiveness of governance. So for example, going back to this island I was talking about, that was one of the islands that was closest to, you know, the mainland. And here you did not have any education. And so for many people around the lake, they lived their lives with no support or even interaction with governments and with politicians. And, you know, again and again in Northeast Nigeria, I kept hearing, we didn't even know government before this crisis. We only knew anything when it was time for elections and politicians would come to campaign. But beyond that, there was no interaction whatsoever. So I think that lack of governance, that lack of effective services has been one of the biggest barriers, both in terms of being a driver of violence. So you have people who are frustrated with the lack of government, with what they see as high levels of corruption and inequality, but also it's a barrier in terms of providing effective services and support to populations affected by the violence. And I also would say that a lack of understanding of gender dynamics and how they operate and how they've been changing, and also social exclusion dynamics as well.
You know, I found the Shoring Up Stability report really useful in illustrating for a security audience the fact that just because something is a security threat does not mean that there's a military solution, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that you sort of touched on that a little bit, and recognizing that we sort of need to expand the toolbox of how we address complex security risks and recognize that it's not necessarily going to be a military or security intervention, even though it might be a security risk, right? So, I think recognizing the need for new approaches to addressing insecurity is going to be really key. And that came out for me really well in the report. Do you see potential? Do you see any movement in sort of the policy realm in terms of identifying new approaches?
Yeah. So, I mean, when pretty much every single person that I spoke to, not just for the report, but, you know, in almost 7 years of working in Northeast Nigeria and the wider Lake Chad region, almost every person, when you ask them what they wanted, the number one thing that they said was security. And the second thing that they said was being able to return to their livelihoods. And this is what people want. They want the security to enable their lives to resume and to be able to rebuild their lives. Now, of course, the first responsibility of any government is to provide security for its citizens. But there are a number of ways that this needs to be done. And what we have seen in the region, unfortunately, is an overemphasis on kinetic approaches. So this idea that we need to defeat the enemy by any cost whatsoever. And this has had severe negative impacts on the lives of civilians, but also led to conflict dynamics developing. It's been a driver of recruitment into armed opposition groups. And one of the reasons why this conflict looks set to continue. Now, in terms of policy approaches, I think there is some understanding of the need to take more holistic approaches. And even, you know, when you speak to people within the Nigerian military, they'll talk about the need to focus more on civilian protection, on good civil-military relations, and taking steps to reduce harm against civilians, which is very positive. But I think there's still a lack of understanding about what that means in practice. At the same time, you have governments talking about the need to not just look at, you know, defeating the enemy, but also providing for citizens, for looking at recruitment dynamics. And so they say these things, but a lot more can be done really to put these words into action.
Do you have some examples of what can be done?
Yeah. So I have an example actually from Niger, which I thought was very positive. And there I spoke to a government official who works at the local government level. And he was talking about looking ahead to future issues caused by climate change and caused by desertification. What you're seeing in the Diffa region of Niger is people who were based in the northern part of the region, and these are pastoralists that I'm talking about, moving further south, not because of lack of pasture, but because of lack of water. Mm-hmm. And so he was predicting that, you know, if people continue to move further south to the area around Lake Chad, this could lead to increased populations, and also, you know, potential tensions around natural resources, land and water. And so he was actually trying to be forward thinking and thinking about what could the government do about this. And he had this solution, which, okay, so the problem is not land, the problem is water sources. So what is there anything that we could do in terms of constructing water sources further north? And I think that is the kind of thinking that we need. We need to be thinking about the situation as it is now and what we need to do, but also projecting and thinking of future trajectories when it comes to climate change, when it comes to conflict dynamics and how they will evolve, but also future trajectories in terms of how climate and conflict will intersect and influence each other, and then program now in light of what may happen in the future. And I always say, like, yes, you should be addressing conflict risk now, but actually at the same time as addressing present conflict risks, like, let's also act to mitigate the root causes of future conflicts.
Chitra, thank you so much for all the extraordinary work and research that you've done in Nigeria, in the region, and for being willing to talk with us today in the midst of a pretty difficult time for the globe. We really appreciate you making the time and putting in the effort. So thank you so much, and we'll look forward to future conversations.
Perfect. Thank you, Lauren. It was a pleasure talking to you.
You've been listening to Friday Podcast from the Wilson Center. Thanks for tuning in. For more information, follow us on Twitter @NewSecurityBeat and visit newsecuritybeat.org.